WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the loss of affordable housing. More poor people are paying a larger part of their income for housing at a time when wages are going down, rents are going up, and government subsidies are drying up. We'll talk with the New York Times' Jason DeParle, who's been following the housing crisis and its impact on low-income families. Also, crossing the Indian Desert with a nomadic tribe of camel herders, we'll meet Robin Davidson. She tells us about living without any solitude and without any sleep. Like the rest of the tribe, she had to stay alert at night for attacks from antagonistic locals. She writes about her adventure in her new book, Desert Places. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Aviation authorities in India fear 350 people died when two passenger planes collided in midair near New Delhi today. Reporter Edmund Roy says one passenger plane from Saudi Arabia had just left the airport before it crashed into the other plane from Kazakhstan.
One plane, the Saudi Airlines, was on its way to Jeddah. It had just taken off 10 minutes ago. The other one was coming into land, the Kazakh Airways. So, and this happened something like 115 kilometers west of Delhi in a place called Dadri. We do know that the wreckage is strewn over some 15 kilometers across three villages. It's also a very thickly populated area. Nevertheless, we haven't yet heard of any casualties on the ground.
If the death toll is confirmed, the air disaster will be among the world's five worst for loss of life. The Army says three non-commissioned officers at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, have been charged with sexual misconduct. The Army says none of the charges include rape or forcible sodomy. These charges come after the Army announced a series of sexual misconduct charges at a Maryland training facility. Snow is expected to fall throughout the day in the Great Lakes region. Forecasters are measuring snowfall totals in feet. Lorna Jordan of member station WCPN reports from Cleveland.
For the time being, the weather pattern appears stalled over northern Ohio and Michigan. As much as 40 inches of snow have fallen in some places which traditionally get lake-effect snows. The heavy snowfall is hampering power crews, which are still struggling to restore heat and electricity to thousands of people in the Cleveland area. It will be at least tomorrow before many of those people can return home from Red Cross shelters. Road crews are trying to keep the interstates clean with a combination of plowing, salt, and round-the-clock work. Schools in many areas remain closed for a second day, and some businesses are even being affected. However, stores selling shovels, salt, and snowblowers are doing landmark business. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cleveland.
Families of French victims of the TWA Flight 800 explosion say they're sending a private investigator to the United States. Relatives say this is not tied to a claim by retired journalist Pierre Salinger that a Navy missile may have accidentally brought down the jet. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Jose Cremetes, head of an association of families of the victims, said the group will send an aviation expert to work in close collaboration with American officials. He said the families felt the investigation has been dragging, and they're frustrated because they aren't getting much information. Right now, our only source of information is the press, he said. Cremetes lost his 15-year-old son in the disaster. He said because French families are so far away from the United States, some fear that investigators are hiding something. There's lots of publicity here of a cover-up, he said. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 9 points at 6,264. In active trading, the NASDAQ is up 2 points. This is NPR. The third annual Middle East-North African Economic Conference is underway in Cairo. NPR Suni Khalid reports.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher urged delegates at the annual economic conference to seize the opportunity of the peace process and help generate regional prosperity.
The peace process must move forward in both its political and its economic dimension. And we share a commitment that we should deepen the partnerships between government and the private sector so that peace can endure and thrive. Today, the world can look to Cairo, can look to this economic conference as a vote of confidence in the peace process.
Later, Christopher told delegates that an agreement was near on the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the West Bank city of Hebron. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
A very little humanitarian aid has been sent into eastern Zaire. These are the first such supplies in more than a month of fighting between rebels and Zairean army troops. The food that got in was not enough to feed the residents of Goma. Zairean authorities say they will allow more aid into the country, but relief workers say Zairean authorities no longer control the eastern part of the country. The rebels do. One rebel leader says he will allow relief aid in, but remnants of the former Rwandan army are still blocking access to most of the Rwandan refugees in the Zairean area. Germany's highest court has let convictions stand for three former East German leaders. The men were convicted for ordering killings at the former East-West German border. The German Constitutional Court upheld the convictions of a former East German defense minister, his senior aide, and a Communist Party leader. For years, East German law required border guards to kill people who tried to escape to the West. The defendants argued their trial was illegal, saying they were only carrying out the law of the sovereign state. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. The federal government estimates that households should pay no more than 30% of their pre-tax income on shelter. That's its definition of what makes housing affordable. But an increasing number of poor people, including the working poor, pay 50% and more to put a roof over their heads. And this year, the federal public housing program, which helps the poor through rent subsidies and government-built and run housing projects, received drastic cuts. In a New York Times Magazine story last month entitled The Year That Housing Died, staff writer Jason DeParle says that in legislating these cuts, the federal government has essentially conceded defeat in its decades-long drive to make housing affordable to low-income Americans, and few people took notice. DeParle plowed through pages and pages of the voluminous legislation.
I'm not sure anyone has read every word of the housing appropriations bill, but I have read what seems to me to be the most significant line, and it appears on page 29 of the accompanying report. And what it describes is the number of what are called incremental certificates and vouchers. That's a very technical phrase that will mean nothing to anyone but housing analysts. What it means is the number of new families that can get housing assistance next year. It's the premier statistic in housing. It's the one that housing advocates focus on the way pitchers focus on a batter's batting average. It tells you everything you need to know. And this year, for the first time in modern American history, the number has fallen to zero.
So if you're getting housing assistance currently, that will continue?
Yes. It does not affect people who are currently in getting some sort of federal assistance, but it means no new families can join those ranks. And why that is significant is because the number of people waiting for housing assistance is at a record high. There are 5 million families simply on the most distressed element of the waiting list, 5 million with the highest priority. There's another 5 million on top of that who qualify for assistance, but are so far down the waiting list they really have no hope to get it.
And yet the American dream is built around this idea of safe, decent housing, of owning your own house, that somehow that's the promise of America.
Well, it's not just the promise. For most of it's the reality. I mean, the American housing market is the envy of the world. Anyone who's ever traveled through Japan, even briefly, can understand how lavish our housing, how splendid our housing is by the world standards, even by the standards of other wealthy countries. And 2/3 of Americans now own their own homes. It's nearly at a record level. I think it will soon become a record level. That the American housing market for most people is working very well. What we're talking about is a subset of that for whom it's working probably worse than ever, or at least worse than any modern time.
Well, let's get a little
history. Let me qualify that real quickly.
Sure.
I say worse than any time. Those of us who are in the business of talking about and writing about poverty sometimes leave the impression that things are endlessly and always and hopelessly getting worse. And I want to catch myself quickly on that point. When I say they're more troubling at any time, I'm talking about affordability. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all talking about housing quality. By historical standards, and this is important to remember, housing quality in America is better than ever. It's historically speaking, it's not that long ago that many, many Americans had severely substandard homes where they didn't have indoor plumbing, they didn't have windows, they had roofs that leaked terribly. Mostly, I mean, obviously there are examples, but mostly that really seriously substandard housing has been eradicated. That's in great progress, but it's come with a price. The price has been that housing is more expensive than ever, relatively speaking, to the income that unskilled workers can afford. And 20 years ago, there were lots of dilapidated apartments, but people could afford them. Now there are fewer affordable apartments and many more people who need them.
Well, what is then driving up the cost of rents, and what is making houses so unaffordable to so many people?
I think most of it can be explained by the old supply and demand curves. If you go back again 20 years ago when there was a surplus, 20 years ago there were more cheap apartments than there were poor people. Now there are many more poor people than there are cheap apartments. And each of those definitions, poor people and cheap apartments, comes with a kind of technical definition. But for our discussion, if we leave it at that, what happened was a lot of the cheap apartments got bulldozed. They were demolished. Others got gentrified. Others just had the normal process of rent inflation, which with utility costs in the 70s outstripped the general cost of inflation. So housing became an increasingly expensive commodity. That's on the supply side. On the demand side, wages stagnated, particularly for low-income workers. So now you have many more needy people and many fewer cheaper apartments. It's important when you think about housing, the market can respond to a poor person's purse by providing cheaper food, cheaper shoes. There's a lot of ways that in other commodities, the basic market forces can accommodate and provide a good that is less appealing but more affordable to a low-income person. With housing, there's a certain floor beneath which you can't fall. I mean, land costs, taxes, interest rates, those costs are fixed. And there's just no way to build new apartments that are affordable to people at or below the minimum wage or below the poverty line.
Let me shift gears here just slightly and focus on those people that can afford to buy a house. These are people that get a mortgage and property tax deduction for their efforts. Do you think of this as subsidized housing?
Of course I don't. In my day-to-day life, I only do when I put on the hat of a housing analyst, which I think is the way most people who think about it. Most people who are listening to your show and have a mortgage don't think that they're getting a government subsidy, except for that time. once a year when they sit down with their accountant, or once every 5 years when they think about buying a new place, then they absolutely factor in the interest advantage to the mortgage. So yes, of course, in the world of housing policy, that is a subsidy.
And it's something
Most of us couldn't buy our houses without that.
But I assume it's something that society is in support of, because if you own a house, it does bring a kind of stability to wherever it is that you live, that it's in society's interest for people to have stable housing.
Please don't interpret anything I'm saying as being against the mortgage interest subsidy. I just think it's important to keep in mind the amount that we spend on that versus the amount we spend on low-income housing. Sure, it accomplishes many social goods. It gives people a stake in their housing. That gives them a stake in their neighborhoods. Also, is quite a vehicle for wealth accumulation. Most people throughout the course of their lives save more money by owning a house than they do by any other means, by buying stock or putting money in the bank. So it certainly serves a lot of social goods. It's also, like things that do good, expensive. We now spend something like $65 billion a year on the mortgage interest deduction. By spend, I mean that's the cost to the tax code, the amount of money the government would otherwise have. And two-thirds of that money goes to people with incomes above $75,000. There's a kind of perverse incentive in it, which is that the more money you have, the more money the government, the more the government's willing to subsidize your mortgage. The bigger house, the more expensive house you can buy, the greater the government subsidy you get. By contrast to that $66 billion, the entire budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development is only $20 billion. So, and the $66 billion is only one of the tax advantages we give to homeowners. There's probably, if you added it all up with things like capital gains exemptions, you're talking about subsidies to homeowners in the neighborhood of $85, $90 billion a year versus the entire low-income housing budget of about $20 billion a year.
Jason DeParle is our guest, and he's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and writes about poverty. We're talking about a cover story of a couple of weeks ago called The Year That Housing Died, and we're talking about the loss of affordable housing in this country. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason DeParle. He's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, and we're talking about a cover story he did back in the middle of October called The Year That Housing Died. Well, tell us about some of the people that you interviewed in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is really where you focused your story, and how they struggle through this. A family in particular is the family of Harold Coleman.
Well, let me start by telling you why I focused on Charlotte, and it's exactly because it isn't New York or Philadelphia or San Francisco or Chicago. It's not this kind of place that we think of as, oh my, it's a big city and it's got every ill known to man. I mean, if any place you would think would be a manageable community when it comes to housing costs, it's Charlotte. It's a small, or at least a mid-sized southern place where housing costs have typically been low. It's also got a great economy. I mean, there's virtually no unemployment in Charlotte. There's a new 70-story skyscraper reaching toward the high up they had to get an FAA permit to build it to make sure the planes didn't run into it. You know, it's an airport hub. It's got two new sports teams. It's booming. And it's not only got this kind of economic vitality, it also has a real tradition of civic concern. There's a lot of the city government is spending its own money on housing programs. There's a real strong Habitat for Humanity program there. In other words, if you took every possible ingredient you would like or you could imagine for a successful housing economy, Charlotte comes about as close as you could imagine. Good economy, civic concern, low housing costs, and yet. And yet, even in Charlotte, there are thousands of people, working people, who can't afford to pay the rent.
Real tale of two cities in a lot of ways.
And I was one of the things that struck me as I was reading through the city does an official housing plan every year, and even they start quoting Dickens. I mean, they're as proud as any other group of city officials about their local community, and with many reasons, you know, they have a right to be proud. They've done a lot of wonderful things in Charlotte, and yet even when they're describing their own housing economy, they quote from A Tale of Two Cities and to describe what's happening in Charlotte.
Well, one of the families that you focus on, and I think have a great deal of affection for the way you write, is the family of Harold Coleman. Tell us how he and his family have tried to survive in Charlotte, a place, as you say, that's really probably the most receptive place in this country for people of all incomes.
Well, you know, the life of a social policy reporter is a strange thing. You swoop into people's lives for an hour or a day, and you learn all about them, and then of course you leave and you don't ever see them again. And this happened to me with Harold Coleman. 5 years ago, when I first went to Charlotte, I was first time I did a housing story about Charlotte. I went there and I met this man named Harold Coleman, who was a kitchen worker in a downtown hotel making something like $5 an hour. And he had a wife and two young sons, and he was spending something like 60% of his income to keep them in an apartment. The part that leapt out to me about the story was that one day he was asleep at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the police came and knocked on his door, grabbed Harold Coleman, and took him off to jail. His offense was he had become an electricity pirate.
Right.
He didn't have the money to pay a down payment for the utility, so he had plugged I saw the alarm clock, plugged his alarm clock with the big red digital letters into his snake day and extension cord out his patio back door. And put it in an outside outlet that belonged to his neighbor, and his neighbor complained, and the police had come and arrested him. So, as I've gone through writing 100 stories since then, I've from time to time kind of thought back on this poor guy Harold Coleman, who'd almost become a larger than life character to me. You know, the man arrested for stealing electricity for his alarm clock, and
an alarm clock that he was using to work.
To go to work, exactly. So I went back to Charlotte in part because I had that intriguing encounter with him, but not in the least bit expecting I would ever see him again. Or, you know, most particularly poor people tend to move so much, you know, it's hard to find them 2 months later. But I got down to Charlotte, and I looked through the phone book, and his name wasn't there. And I called the hotel where he used to work, and he wasn't there. And I was just going on finding other people, and I found the original notebook that I had carried from 5 years earlier. And there was a number in there, and I thought, well, what the heck? I picked up the phone and dialed it, never expecting, you know, never imagining that I would find him. And he answered on the first ring.
Huh. Waiting for your phone call, no
Almost
doubt.
As though, yeah, because he was exactly there waiting for me to call. And he was very matter-of-fact. He said, oh, yeah, well, I'm not very good with phone numbers, so we kept the same one. So a couple hours later, there I was driving up into his driveway. One of the things that struck me when I pulled up into the house was there was a kind of battered old Toyota or Honda in the driveway, and there was a radio, a license plate advertising a Christian radio station. And one of the important things in Harold and his wife's life is they've become very religious in the past 4 or 5 years. Everything seems to be turning up roses for them. They have a good new job, two healthy kids. They found a strong marriage. They belong to a church. They found the religion. Everything is going well, except for the rent.
Right.
Twice in the last 2 years, Harold and his wife have had the utilities cut off. When I say he's got a good new job, I mean, you know, he's working full time. When I found him, he was, again, most recently, he was working as an auto mechanic at the, I think, a local Western Auto, and making something like $7 an hour. You know, not a good wage, but not an awful one by the standards of the local economy, and being far above the minimum wage. But still, he had gotten sick and missed a week of work, and then the car broke down and got behind on some bills, and literally twice within the last 8 months, the family had their utilities cut off. So, you know, those of us who live with a bit more margin of error in our lives, if we get sick, that's a sick day, and the paycheck still comes. That didn't happen for Harold.
The tendency, I think, when looking at the crisis, as you describe it, of affordable housing in this country, is to look for people to blame. I wonder if you can point any fingers, though, to the Department of Housing, whether charges of inefficiency or corruption or an overweight bureaucracy, and point
the
to them.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development would have to be one of the fattest targets in Washington,
sure,
if you wanted to look historically at inefficiency in bureaucracy. Sure, we could look at lots of places where HUD has. I'm not talking about this administration. I'm talking about historically, where it's been a very, going back to the certainly at least till 1980 when Sam Pierce came in there, all kinds of mismanagement problems at HUD, and that they're still trying to, that Jack Kemp tried to dig out from, and Henry Cisneros has been trying to dig out from. All that is true. The point I'm trying to add to that is that I don't think that's the core of the nation's housing problem. You can't blame it on government efficiency. There's not a single villain. It's this intersection of housing inflation, housing costs more and more to provide, and stagnating incomes. People have less and less income. It's an economic mismatch that's at the heart of it.
One figure I read that for the government to build low-income housing, the cost per unit is something like $100,000. That seems like a lot of money to be pouring into a unit that probably doesn't have a jacuzzi and, you know, a lovely porch that wraps around it.
Another way to think about it, we started out by talking about how much it costs, or we're talking about housing vouchers and certificates, which is, this year, the numbers of those voucher certificates have gone to zero for the first time this year. There are no new families being assisted. Well, why is that? The answer for why that is that housing is a uniquely expensive social program to run. Even Medicare, which is, of course, we're all worried is bankrupting the country, it costs $5,000 a year to give a person Medicare. It costs $6,000 on average to give someone a housing certificate. So it's more expensive even than Medicare.
You call this a time of, quote, post-entitlement balance budget world, that we live in a world of post-entitlement balance budget. And I assume one of the reasons that public housing was targeted was that every, like all government programs, everyone's got to take a hit in order to balance the budget. Is a balanced budget good for poor people?
Well, let me amend that slightly. We don't yet live in a post-entitlement balanced budget world. We're talking about trying to get to one. And I think what's interesting about housing is that it offers a glimpse of what that might look like, in that housing has never been an entitlement. And now as we try to get toward a balanced budget, we have to take these deep housing cuts. What that means is only one in three people who qualify for the housing assistance can actually get it. Two out of three people who qualify are simply stuck on a waiting list. I think we would never run, or at least we never have run a medical program that way. You wouldn't say that one of three, all elderly people qualify for Medicare, but only one in three is going to get it. That would obviously not fly, but that is the circumstance that applies in housing. Your question was whether I think a balanced budget is good for poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Low interest rates are good for poor people, sure. I mean, Harold Coleman has a car payment. That helps him. I mean, high inflation hurts, high interest rates hurt poor people. Yes, that is that's one of the things that you have to, you can't just keep spending and spending money. You have to think about the effect of a fiscal responsibility, that has a beneficial effect that poor people share in as well. I think one question you do need to ask, though, is in a time, if you're going to do deficit reduction, do you do it in a way that spreads burdens fairly? And if you look at what we've done so far, almost all the savings have come from the poorest Americans. And we just went through last year, we had a huge year-long debate about how to reduce the deficit. And we talked about Medicare savings, and we talked about this and that. The only thing that actually got done was $55 billion worth of cuts in anti-poverty programs that targeted disabled children, that targeted immigrants, that targeted people on welfare. Again, going back to the mortgage interest questions, we'd spend something like $90 billion subsidizing housing for the affluent and $20 billion subsidizing it for the poor. And when we decide that we have to save money, we start with the $20 billion we're spending on the poor.
Jason DeParle is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more about the crisis in affordable housing in the second part of the show. DeParle's cover story on the issue was featured in the magazine in October. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, solving the housing crisis, we continue our conversation with Jason DeParle of the New York Times. Also, one woman's trek across the Indian desert with a nomadic tribe of camel herders. We'll talk with Australian writer Robin Davidson about her adventure. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain in for Terry Gross. Jason DeParle is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and covers poverty for the publication. We're talking about a cover story he wrote in October about the crisis in affordable housing. He says with rising rents and falling wages, more poor people are paying more of their money for shelter. I wonder if you can look at the private sector or look at programs like Habitat for Humanity or some nonprofit groups that you write about in your article and to say, well, perhaps the federal government can only do so much or spend only so much money, but perhaps the private sector can step in and do the rest. Is that possible based on your analysis, your observations of the affordable housing crisis?
No, I don't think it's possible that you're going to see the charitable sector come in with enough kinds of subsidies to make a big difference. I mean, in Charlotte, Habitat for Humanity, Charlotte has the second most active Habitat for Humanity or second most productive chapter in the country. They build more houses in Charlotte than they have anywhere in the country besides Atlanta. But they've only built 250 houses in 10 years. I mean, they're wonderful houses, and it's a great program, and it makes your soul sing to go look at them and see people have these homes that they've helped build and they can now live in. But when you step back and think that there are 3,000 people on the waiting list and you're building something like 20 homes a year, I don't think you can really point to that as saying that the private sector can do this on its own. What I do think you can say is that there can be a mix. There has to be, I think, to make housing programs work, some public government subsidy. But there are lots of examples of private management, private contributions, public-private partnerships, including in Charlotte, that where you're not just setting up a big public bureaucracy like we did with public housing and saying let the government run it and often run it into the ground. I think you're talking about providing an initial subsidy with some kind of matching grant and having these there's a whole infrastructure of nonprofit housing groups that have grown up, and it's early in the movement. They've only been at this for 10 or 15 years. We don't know what their projects will look like 40 years down the road, but so far the results have really been encouraging.
I wonder what you anticipate the effect of the changes in the welfare program that were signed into law this year, where there's a time limit after 5 years. Those people on welfare are going to have to get some kind of job. I assume many of these people will find, if they're lucky enough to find jobs, will find them at minimum wage. Throw them then into the housing market. How are they going to survive?
Well, I think the welfare bill raises two kinds of questions. One is what happens to the people who don't get the jobs. So to start there, imagine you're running a public housing program and the people in these apartments already have quite little money. Some of them are relying on welfare checks of, say, $300 a month. What happens when that $300 a month goes to zero? Well, your ability to collect rent goes even lower. So in most of these public housing units are already running the government provides, it's interesting the way this works. Every year the government makes an estimate of how much it would cost to run public housing for the year, say $3 billion. Then it provides less than that, say 2.5. Every year it's a percentage, you know. So by the government's own estimates, it's providing less than it costs to keep those programs, to keep those apartments maintained. So what you see is a steady deterioration over time. And that's just going to accelerate when the incomes of the people in those projects decline further. That's for the people who don't succeed, for the people who stay in public housing. For the people who are able to go out and get jobs and move out, you have a different set of questions. How are they going to afford a place to live in this economy where plenty of people with incomes at the $6 and $7 an hour level are still paying 50% of their income for shelter?
This may be an unfair question, and it's clear that there are no villains in this story of the lack of affordable housing, nor are there simple solutions.
It's the worst kind of story to try to tell, and it's probably one reason why it doesn't get told. You know?
Well, if perhaps, again, this is an unfair question, but if you could fix it, if you could fix the problem, and I know you can't, how would you do that? Where would you go first?
I think part of what the government doing right now makes sense, which is to try to fix the worst symbols of Part of the reason we don't spend more money on housing is that people don't believe it would do any good. And the reason they don't believe it would do any good is because when they think of subsidized housing, they think of big city housing projects and they think of failure and waste. So Henry Cisneros hopes that if he can go to the 40 biggest cities in the country and take down the worst of these buildings and replace them with developments that seem to work as viable communities. That can be the beginning of building a constituency of political support for housing programs. So both programmatically and politically, I think that's one good place to start.
Would you also want to continue and extend and add to then the rent subsidies and to look at the millions of people who don't even qualify at this? I mean, who do qualify but can't get in the program?
Well, certainly spending, if I had an extra billion to put in the housing budget, I would certainly want some of it to go to the Section 8 program, which is the cheapest or the fastest and most efficient way to get people housing. And also by giving it the subsidy to the person rather than to a project, it gives them, the buzzword would be, it empowers them. Mm-hmm. It allows them to go, if they don't like where they live, they can get up and move. And there have been some very interesting housing experiments with that that people have been very successful in getting out of these big city ghettos and into suburban neighborhoods, better jobs, better schools, because they can actually take the subsidy and go find a more decent place to live. So I'm very enthusiastic about that subset of housing programs. They're called mobility programs. They give poor people the subsidy themselves and allow them to go out and try to find a better life.
I'm curious whether you think your articles in the New York Times Magazine, which has very glossy ads, there's usually a section on very expensive fashions, whether you want well-off people in this country to either be uncomfortable with their luck in life or to rethink their relationship to poor people or to rethink their relationship to the government.
Well, did you say, do I want them to be unhappy?
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, I suppose people who go into the business of poverty reporting at some in some dark recess of their mind have the hope that our writing will make the comfortable uncomfortable and comfort those with who have little. Not in a literal sense in that I think there's anything wrong with working hard and enjoying the fruits of your labor, but perhaps in a psychological sense, I think those of us who are more privileged, as we go about our lives day to day, we tend to think that we've earned everything we get. And when you step back, life seems a little bit more, at least to have a little bit more of a lottery aspect to it. Not entirely, but there's some of what we get we earn, and some of what we get by dint of good luck. And it's, I think, helpful to be reminded of that.
Well, Jason DePauw, we're going to end on that note, and I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jason DePauw is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. His cover story on the crisis in affordable housing appeared in October. This is Fresh Air. Robin Davidson doesn't take the kind of trips you read about in glossy travel brochures. She's looking for a different kind of experience. In the late 70s, she trekked across the deserts of her native Australia on camel, accompanied only by her dog. The 1,700-mile journey became a book called Tracks. In the early 90s, she set off with a tribe of nomads in India called the Rabari, who were taking their camels and sheep on their annual migration, searching for greener pastures. As she writes about it in her new book, Desert Places, it was the most trying experience she has ever had, and it cured her of her romantic notions of travel in other cultures. It took a long time, with many false starts, to begin her journey with the Rabari. I asked her how she finally convinced them to take her along.
Sheer persistence and eventual luck. The reason they didn't want me along, it was nothing personal. I think they did want me along because I was going to pay them money, and I think I provided sort of cheap entertainment for them. So it wasn't that they didn't want me there, but they felt that if something happened to me, if I got kidnapped or if I had, you know, had my kneecaps busted by dacoits, which is the sort of thing that happens to them all the time, if that happened to me, they'd be held responsible. And they're in no position within within the sort of power hierarchies of India to have any kind of power. So, for example, one group of women at one point, I think they didn't... I'd asked them if I could travel with them, and they said, yes, of course you can, we'd love to have you with us. And then a week or two later, I received word that they'd decided I couldn't come with them because on migration I would have to sleep with the women, naturally. And as I was so obviously a man in drag... I would make them pregnant, and how would they explain this to everyone? So they would come up with these elaborate excuses of why I couldn't come. Eventually, after a year of driving around Rajasthan, you know, just asking group after group after group, I crossed the border into a neighbouring state, Gujarat, and I think for some reason the people there aren't so frightened. They're not quite so up against the wall. And I quite quickly found a group who were willing to take me, and those were the people I stayed with for 3 months.
I'd like to have you describe this Rabari tribe for us, and you describe them as a camel-breeding subcaste.
Yes, well, it's quite complicated. The Rabaris are a caste of pastoral nomads in northwest India. They call themselves either Raika or Rabari. The Raika are a subcaste of the larger caste called the Rabari, and they tend to be camel herders. But because life is so difficult for them now, I mean, there's no grazing left in India. There's huge, tremendous competition for resources, you know, between nomads and farmers, for example. And because of that, migration is terribly difficult for them now. So a lot of them are changing from camels to sheep, which are more lucrative. And they're shifting out of their home state, which is Jaisalmer, into sort of shifting south into the greener areas of India in order to try and feed their animals.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Rabari travel by foot, and the what they do is they travel across a portion of India, herding their camels and their sheep to market, and you hitched along for the ride, so to speak. How did you prepare yourself to travel by foot?
That wasn't too hard for me. I mean, first of all, they're not actually taking their sheep to market. What they're doing is it's an annual migration in which they're really looking for pasture to keep their sheep going because there's not enough pasture around the home village. So they'll spend 2 months in a village around the monsoon time when there's grass. And then as that grass dies off, they have to go looking for it. So they're away usually for 10 months. But that, of course, can change. If, for example, the rains fail at home, the monsoon fails, then they just have to keep going. And often they will cross into another state looking for pasture and set up a new village. As for how I prepared for it, because it was so chaotic, because every plan I made just fell apart as soon as I thought it was about to happen, the idea of preparing, I sort of let go the idea of preparing for anything. I just sort of took whatever came. So when these people agreed to having me along, I just ran out there. I just grabbed it while I could. So there was very little preparation in that sense. I just jumped in the deep end and sort of did it.
Well, you also ate and drank everything, hoping to teach your body to, as you write, accommodate the bugs. Did it work?
I was terribly lucky. I mean, obviously I'd taken as many precautions as I thought was sensible. I had rabies injections and, you know, all those sorts of things. And I took malaria tablets. But what I couldn't stave off were infections from the dust because, you know, if you're travelling with 5,000 sheep and sleeping in the middle of this tightly packed flock of sheep, you're just breathing in black muck all the time. So I got ear, nose and throat infections and was running a temperature for the whole time I was with them, really. But they all had chronic malaria, flu, infections and so on. And, we, you know, we just kept going. They were the most tough, resilient people. Like, you know, the men with a temperature of 105 with malaria would just go out with their sheep every day.
Did you learn to accommodate illness, fever, and keep going?
Well, I had to. I mean, I didn't learn to. I just had to. It was either that or go home. What I did discover and what I really loved about them was the way that they turned adversity into humour. So no matter how rough things got, and they got very, very rough, we would gather around the fires at night and we'd start laughing about it. And the tougher things got, the harder we would laugh. And it, you know, they used humor as a survival mechanism.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, which asks some interesting questions.
Sure. To those who have a romantic view of travel, or who, longing for the liberty they imagine it brings, wish that they, too, could throw off old jobs, old husbands, old responsibilities, and head for wilder climes where, they feel sure, both life and themselves will be entirely different, that is to say, better, who do not understand that one carries the self like a heavy old suitcase wherever one goes, who think of travel not as a line of inquiry, a satisfaction of curiosity, or as a method by which to better understand the world, but as an escape from banality, I have this to say. When you are so tired, frustrated, and filthy that you would like to cry but cannot because people are watching you. When your period has come and you are in pain but you must not display it. When you do not know what is going on because you cannot understand the language but you sense the atmosphere is not right. When you have entered a place where the people are suspicious of you or frightened of you or hate you because you represent something evil to them. When there are children, hundreds of them, pressing up against you, shouting, pulling at your hair and clothes, or pelting you with rocks. When you are so fed up with humanness that you would like to shoot everyone you see, including yourself. When the village dogs race towards you howling and slavering, and when, finally, you make it back to the tent to have a cup of tea, the only luxury you have, you find that the milk has turned to yogurt. When there is no one with whom to have a sensible conversation, nor is there likely to be anyone for months. When you realize how very far away from you are the places and people you understand and who understand you. When your Celtic skin, which blushes even under a weak northern sun, has been baked into pottery by sun and salt, so that you have to stop yourself thinking of the cancers which surely must be forming, let alone the years you are adding to your face. When the little beasts that have taken up residence in your stomach double you up in a cramp so that you have to run behind a dune, even though there are people everywhere watching. And when you have so lost touch with why you are doing what you are doing, that it seems you are trapped in a machine of meaninglessness, in which moral values are mashed to a pulp, and yet, because of an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, you cannot liberate yourself by cancelling an article for a magazine. When you have plumbed the very depths of banality, then you begin to wonder if it is worth it.
Were you lonely?
Yes. Painfully lonely, but in a way that... I think it was that worst combination of loneliness without solitude. So I had no way of... I think I was homesick for my language, but I could never be alone. So I never had a chance to sort of go and crawl off somewhere by myself and de-scramble the brains. There were constantly people around me, and constantly they were trying to make me speak and understand.
So you felt like you couldn't even talk to yourself in your own language as a way of keeping yourself company or giving yourself that kind of comfort?
I think what we require solitude in order to come back to ourselves in some way. And Westerners need solitude a lot. I mean, I think that's another profound difference in the cultures. I think individual Indians are fundamentally members of some group, and Westerners are not. And they don't seem to need the place to be on their own. And that was terribly difficult for me. That was really, really difficult. Just never, ever, ever being alone. I couldn't even go to the loo without 20 people watching me, you know.
Robin Davidson's book about her travels with a tribe of nomads in India called the Rabari is called Desert Places. We'll talk more in just 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Robin Davidson is our guest, and her book is called Desert Places, and it's about her journey with the Rabari tribe of India, crossing the desert of India with their animals, looking for pasture for the animals. You also talk about the fact that you were, and one would assume, would be the object of curiosity. Here you were with this Rabari tribe. You were stared at a lot, stared at with something that you described as a subcontinental stare. Describe what that is for us.
Imagine yourself as a television. A television that people, sort of a television in the 50s. You remember how people used to gather in front of windows when televisions first came out and just stare and stare and stare? That is exactly what it's like. Only there are a million people, and they are very, very close to you, pressing up against you. It is a very alienating experience.
Yeah. What would you do? Stare, look back? Look away?
I sort of did everything. And what was most unsettling for me is the sort of anger that it... this response that I really hated in myself was this fury and anger, because I felt like I was having my skin ripped off. And of course, there was no hostility in this stare, or maybe there was sometimes, but generally it was just frank curiosity. Mm-hmm. My method in the end for dealing with it was just to close down, a sort of psychic closing down. You know, I might walk into a village with the women and instantly these people would collect around us and I'd just kind of turn my brain off. I sort of wouldn't be there.
The people that you followed, the Rabari, live a nomadic life, a life that is probably endangered by modern life. What kind of person gets created out of living nomadically?
Well, you see, I've got a terrible bias in this direction. I think a better kind of person, in the sense that moving all the time mitigates against accumulating possessions. So that's one thing. People who move together in a group have to rely on each other. In this case, for example, the nomads, when they go on migration, constantly giving each other information about where the feed is best, where there's water, where there's a bad farmer, where there's a good farmer. Individuals, it would often be it would often be in an individual's interest to lie, but they never, never do, because they have a sense of this greater good. And I find that entirely admirable. There are other more obvious things like the status of women. Women in moving cultures tend to have a much higher status and independence. Fewer children, of course, in India that means quite a lot. There are all sorts of things. But I think also in the personality somehow there is this generosity, because they're constantly having to deal with difference. They're constantly having to negotiate otherness wherever they go. And this gives them a kind of broadness of spirit that I think more insular people don't have.
Do you think you're a nomad, in a way?
Yeah. Well, a sort of new form of nomad,
right.
I think. Obviously, I mean, it's ironic, isn't it, that in the century where in which traditional nomadism will probably disappear, we've got the largest movements of population that have ever happened. But there, it's a different kind of nomadism. It's about not belonging anywhere. It's about trying to belong somewhere. It's about being uprooted. So it's just an irony that while one thing is happening, another thing is dying off.
Well, Robin Davidson, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Robin Davidson's book is called Desert Places. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Lawrence Donahue Green. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.